This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode, we are joined by Angela Frederick. Angela is in the Sociology Department at Rhodes College. She researches and teaches in the areas of gender, disability, family, and politics. We discuss her article, Mothering While Disabled, which appears in the fall 2014 issue of Context Magazine. Hi, Angela. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You begin your feature with a powerful vignette about Michaela Sinnett that draws attention to an issue that a lot of people simply don't think about, and it's one that I had not really thought about before. Would you mind sharing Michaela's story with our listeners?
Yeah, so when she was 2 days old, Michaela was removed from the custody of her parents and placed into foster care. The Missouri Department of Social Services removed her from the custody of her parents while her mother was still in the hospital, so just a couple of days after childbirth. And we might ask, well, what horrible crime did Michaela's parents commit to cause them to lose their parenting rights before they even had the chance to care for their child? And Michaela's parents weren't guilty of abuse or neglect. They were guilty of being blind. Michaela's mother had some difficulty breastfeeding. She attempted to breastfeed immediately after childbirth. There was no staff around assisting in this process. She immediately realized something was wrong and pulled the baby off and asked the nurse for help. And the nurse came over and said, well, your baby turned slightly blue. Your breast was covering her nose, but it's okay. It happens to many mothers. It's not a big deal. But the nurse in turn wrote on Michaela's chart that the family is in need of 100% assistance. This enacted a visit from the hospital social worker who grilled the family for several hours about how they would care for their daughter being blind. And in the end, the social worker was not happy with their answers. The answer that she wanted was that they had a plan to have a sighted person with them at all times, which the couple could not make such a promise. And so she committed the child to foster care. It took the couple 57 days to get their daughter back. During this time, they were only able to see their daughter 2 to 3 times a week and only under supervision. And after 2 months of legal hearings and legal action, the Missouri Department of Social Services dropped the case.
Wow. So this case is obviously very shocking and has a very emotionally powerful, but what about it caught your attention and made it a topic that you wanted to research and write about?
Well, on a personal level, at the time, I am blind myself. You should let your audience know that. And I'm also a sociologist by training. At the time that this case made media attention, it really sent shockwaves through the blind community. And many young people like myself looked at that story and thought, well, this could be me. It's only a matter of luck. Most blind mothers will tell you that they are visited by social workers in the hospital after childbirth, and it only takes one social worker, one hospital staff who says, I can't fathom how a blind person can safely care for a child before you're run through the ringer and face the threat of having your child removed. And so on a personal level, during this time, I had been married for a couple of years, and my husband and I were thinking about starting a family. So this story really hit home for me. On the professional level, I was working on my doctoral studies, and my dissertation was on the experiences of women in Texas politics. I hadn't yet thought about analyzing disability experiences through sociological lenses, but I started to really take a look at the literature on mothering. We have an expansive literature on mothering in sociology, but the experiences of mothers with disabilities are nearly invisible in this literature. So we tend to assume this binary of care, that mothers are non-disabled women who are caring for, and when disability comes into the story, it's the people for whom women, non-disabled women, care. But if we think about our own lives and our own family experiences, of course we know that we don't fall neatly into these categories of non-disabled caregiver and disabled care receiver. Our lives are much more complex than that. And so in my new research, I really wanted to get at those complexities, interrogate that binary of care by examining and exploring the experiences of mothers with sensory and physical disabilities.
So how did you go about conducting the research? Who were you talking to? Were you conducting interviews, or what were you actually doing?
Yes, I have conducted 42 interviews with mothers who have physical, sensory, or systemic impairments. I've also conducted 3 focus groups with blind mothers particularly.
Okay. So what type of patterns did you find in the way that the disabled mothers were actually treated by the state?
In my research, and keep in mind this is qualitative research, in my research I found that about 1 in 4 mothers with physical and sensory disabilities faces serious threats to her right to parent. And these threats come in the form of social service investigations, but they also come in the form of custody battles in family courts. And so one place that is of a tremendous threat to the rights of disabled mothers and disabled parents in general is in family courts. And family courts, judges have incredible latitude to make custody decisions based on the measuring stick that is the best interest of the child. So you can imagine the kind of decisions that can be made when a judge doesn't know much about disability, doesn't know the strategies that people with various disabilities employ to effectively parent, and makes decisions, custody decisions, based on a parent's disability. And so in my research, I found that about 1 in 4 of these mothers have faced serious threats to their right to parent.
So as you detail in the article, there's a long history of exclusion of people living with disability, in particular mothers. Could you provide us with a bit of that historical context?
Yes, in many ways, we are still living out the legacy of the eugenics movement of the last century. So under the eugenics movement, multiple forms of oppression sort of collided. So disability was a central organizing principle in drawing these boundaries between who was a fit mother and who was an unfit mother. We also, of course, during the eugenics movement, see much class and racial oppression being intertwined with disability oppression to draw those boundaries. And under the eugenics movement, we saw the state really playing this heavy hand in shaping who could and could not reproduce. So mothers with disabilities and other mothers deemed to be unfit or unworthy to reproduce faced marriage restriction laws, faced forced institutionalization, and faced forced sterilization practices at the hands of the state. For any of you who are interested, I would highly recommend taking a look at the story of Carrie Buck. She was the woman at the center of the Supreme Court ruling, the Buck versus Bell case, which legalized forced sterilization performed by the state. It's a very interesting and troubling story. Now we've moved into an era that many call the new eugenics. So under the new eugenics, we still have all of these cultural values, these beliefs about who is fit to reproduce, who should reproduce, and who should refrain from having children. So those cultural values are still in place that suggest that disabled women should refrain from having children, both because they pose a threat to their children through what's perceived to be inadequate mothering practices, but also that disabled mothers threaten this imagined progressive future without disability that we all should be working toward. And so under the new eugenics, though, we still have these cultural values around disability and reproduction, but the state steps back in the new eugenics, and now women are expected to self-regulate. And if we look at much of the hype, much of the judgment and expectations around pregnant women, for example, much of it is rooted in a fear of disability, that, you know, it's the woman's responsibility to do all that she can to protect this envisioned future without disability. And where does that leave disabled women in this story? In many ways, disabled women expose those cultural beliefs, make them very raw and very visible. And in turn, disabled women face a tremendous amount of prejudice around their decision to have children.
I'm curious, does the eagerness of the state to keep this watchful and it appears not very friendly eye on people living with disabilities intersect with other qualities that a mother might possess and sociologists often study, so particularly in regards to race or class or even relationship status?
Most certainly. We saw that with the eugenics movement, of course, and even under the new eugenics, those boundaries that we draw between the so-called good mother and the so-called bad mother. Disability is part of that story, that cultural work, but most certainly class and race are also still part of those boundaries. And in fact, one of the things that's really interesting that's come out of my interviews with disabled mothers is the experience of middle-class white disabled mothers. So in some ways, middle-class white disabled mothers, they should be insulated from the watchful eye of medical institutions and the state. They're culturally defined as adequate good mothers. But of course, when you throw disability in the mix, these middle-class white mothers fall under the gaze of the state in ways that poor mothers, teen mothers, drug-addicted mothers, and mothers from ethnic and racial minority groups experience. So the place of white, middle-class, disabled mothers is an interesting one. What's also interesting is the ways in which these mothers make sense of their experiences. And I most certainly found that some of these white, middle-class mothers would try to reinforce those boundaries between good and bad mothers, but putting themselves on the good mother side of the dichotomy. So they would say, I can't believe all this suspicion over me when I'm a good, caring mother. It's the crack addict mother down the hall. That's the mother that these people need to be focused on. So those discourses still ran very strong in my interviews.
Okay, that's fascinating. Have there actually been any numbers that have validated the state's concerns?
In terms of, should we be asking questions about disabled parenting?
Yes, exactly.
You know, that's a hard question to answer because we actually don't have good national data on the experiences of disabled parents and their children. So what we know comes mostly from qualitative research. Qualitative research generally shows, although disabled parents face barriers such as issues with transportation, higher poverty rates, higher rates of unemployment, the research generally shows that disabled parents are no more likely to maltreat their children than the general population of parents. And what we find is that disability is often used by the courts, by social services, as a proxy for measuring child maltreatment. And the research shows that this is not a great way to measure what's going on in the home. That most certainly we do see disabled parents who are maltreating their children. Disabled parents run the gamut of parenting skills, access to services, access to resources. But in general, disability is not a good proxy for measuring child maltreatment. So we want to move toward thinking about developing policies that really ask specific questions about what's going on in the home rather than hypothesizing or rather than doing, I'm going to borrow a term from the sociologist Laura Malden here, there's great imagination work that often takes place surrounding disability. So you know, when you don't know anything about what it's like to be deaf, and we can't fathom, well, how do you know when your child is crying? Well, deaf parents have been using strategies to negotiate those situations their entire lives. We're embedded in communities that share strategies. And so when people aren't familiar with those strategies, aren't familiar with these communities, there's a great deal of hypothesizing that takes place. There's a great deal of imagination work. And so we really want to move to policies that look at what's actually going on in the home rather than basing decisions off of imagination work.
That ties in really well to the next question I wanted to ask. I was hoping that we could conclude with a brief reflection on how using a sociological lens to examine this issue shifts the type of questions that are asked and also our understanding of mothers with disabilities. And you were getting a bit at that with your last answer, but I was hoping you could elaborate.
Okay, I'll just start the whole answer over. Yeah, so I think Tay Meadows, a presentation a few years ago at the American Sociological Association annual meeting, provides a great model for this. So in engaging in debates about gay parenting, she says we can't let other people define our sociological agenda, our research agenda. So asking questions of whether or not disabled mothers should have children, asking questions about do disabled mothers provide poor care to their children? Those are questions that don't center the experience of these parents and their children. So this is something that I talk to my sociology students, my undergraduate students, about quite a bit, because we'll read an article about disabled mothers, and then their discussion question for their reflection papers will jump back to, well, should these women have children in the first place? And we want to really think about asking questions that center the experiences of these mothers. And in interviewing these mothers, I'll tell you that many of them have had challenges around disability and parenting. But they also argue that they make very unique and meaningful contributions to parenting.
So I did say that the last question was how we're going to conclude, but I am curious, is this part of a larger project, or will you be writing about this in other places? So if people read the context article and they want to learn more, are there places they can eventually read your work?
Yes, I've just completed the data collection stage of my research. So as I mentioned before, I've conducted 42 interviews with mothers and 3 focus groups, and so I am in the process of writing right now. So definitely keep your eye out for future articles.
Yeah, and in academia, it's always sometimes writing turns into a longer process than expected. So
exactly.
But thank you again for joining us. That was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. This is for you.